in the tail to make more eggs, and meat enough in the eggs to make another blue tail. It seems to me like a meditation on the futility of revenge, or perhaps a gory illustration of the most damning law of physics, the law of conservation of mass. Mass can neither be created nor destroyed. Most of his stories had this quality. They portrayed a claustrophobic world in which the characters could not escape the cold rules of our universe. In another story, a girl named Barbara is attacked by a coyote that sneaks through her window one night. A gruesome fight scene ensues, ending finally when Barbara grabs a doll and stuffs it farther and farther down the coyote's throat until he sneezes and, in cartoonish adherence to Boyle's law, which states that as volume decreases, pressure increases, his head pops off. There was no true magic, even for children, just survival born of the creative harnessing of these cold, harsh rules. Finding no secret formula for faith in his children's stories, I moved on to his satires about psiosophy. What had started as playful one-off jabs at parapsychologists had blossomed into a full-blown creed that, quote, trying to believe what we know is not true, could be society's downfall. Suffering, sickness, ignorance, and war were just a few of the things David pinned on magical thinking. In a piece called Science and Psiosophy, published in Science in 1924, he hails Giordano Bruno, the 16th century astronomer burned at the stake for believing Earth was not the center of the universe, as a hero. According to legend, before his execution, Bruno quipped, "Ignorance is the most delightful science in the world, because it is acquired without labor or pains and keeps the mind from melancholy." And David uses the quote to indict his readers, to warn that if they've ever chosen to shut out hard truths in the name of happiness, they are complicit with Bruno's killers. He was sounding more and more like my father. The way to live was, in every breath, to concede your insignificance and make your meaning from there. Everywhere I looked, I saw it. Stern warnings against hubris, against magical thinking. In his syllabus for a course on evolution, for example, he sneaks in a whole section on the cosmic impotence of man. "Nature no respecter of persons," he writes. "Tampering impossible, her laws immutable. He who defies them wields a club of air." I can only imagine the impassioned diatribes that accompanied these notes, his fist held high in the air, his cosmically impotent fist. You can even find it in his essays on temperance. Why, in the end, was he so opposed to drugs? Because they allow you to feel more powerful than you are. Or as he puts it, they, quote, force the nervous system to lie. Alcohol, for example, lets drinkers, quote, feel warm when they are really cold, to feel good without warrant, to feel emancipated from those restraints and reserves which constitute the essence of character building. In other words, a rosy view of yourself was anathema to self-development, a way to keep yourself stagnant, stunted, morally inchoate, a fast track to sad saccharity. So if this truly was his worldview, if he was so wary of overconfidence, how on earth did he manufacture his persistence? How did he get himself up and out the door on the worst of days when everything seemed lost, crumbled, hopeless? At last I got my hands on what looked like the most promising lead, a small black book called The Philosophy of Despair. In it, David confesses that the trouble with the scientific worldview was that when you pointed it at the meaning of life, it showed you one thing: futility. The fires we kindle die away in coals. Castles we build vanish before our eyes. The river sinks in the sands of the desert. Whichever way we turn, we may describe the course of life in metaphors of discouragement. So what were you supposed to do? Puritan that he is, David recommends the unidling of hands. The, quote, soul ache vanishes, he writes, with active out-of-door life and the consequent flow of good health. He claims that salvation lies in the electricity of our bodies. Happiness comes from doing, helping, working, loving, fighting, conquering, he writes in a syllabus from around the same time, from the exercise of functions, from self-activity. Don't overthink it, I think, is his point. Enjoy the journey, savor the small things, the, quote, luscious taste of a peach, the, quote, lavish colors of tropical fish, the rush from exercise that allows one to experience the, quote, stern joy which warriors feel. Toward the end of the book, he quotes Thoreau, There is no hope for you unless the bit of sod under your feet is the sweetest to you in this world, in any world. And then he sends his readers off with a rousing chant of Carpe Diem. Nowhere is the sky so blue, the grass so green, the sunshine so bright, the shade so welcome as right here, now, today. And what if you're having a bad day? Well, David has very little sympathy for people having bad days. The ultimate conclusion of the philosophy of despair is that despair is a choice. While he thinks it's a natural phase of adolescence, he mocks those who can't shake it. He calls them lazy, whiner posers who are putting on the, quote, fad of the drooping spirit to imitate the, quote, sad kings of literature. He accuses them of having sulfurous breath, the whiff of death. He says that the problem with spending one's time pondering the futility of it all is that you divert that precious electricity gifted to you by evolution, those sacred ions that could make you feel so many wonderful sensations and think so many wonderful ideas. And you flush it all down the drain of existential inquiry, causing you to literally, quote, die while the body is still alive. I felt a familiar shame washing over me. It was the same feeling I'd get when I'd watch my dad belly flop into a frigid lake and emerge whooping with a frothy smile. Why was I so unable to live like him? What was I doing wrong? Desperate for an answer, I kept reading, ransacking David's diatribes on hygiene, on humor, on diplomacy, on pacifism, his poems, his lecture notes, his polemics against alcohol and lipstick and war. And finally, one afternoon, I found it. An antidote to terror, a recipe for hope. It was buried at the bottom of a syllabus for a course he taught called Philosophy of Evolution. It turned out he had devoted a whole course day to my very conundrum, the problem with accepting the scientific worldview. Do these views of life lead to pessimism? Toward the end of his lecture, he offers his students a kind of magic spell, a way of diffusing the chill of chaos in courier type just 31 letters long. There is grandeur in this view of life. I was horrified. There it was. My dad's very same trick. The words that hang in a frame over his desk to this very day. Darwin's call to arms. As different as David had seemed from my dad, as defiant and hopeful and full of faith, he had nothing new to offer me after all. Just a reminder of what I'd always been told. There is grandeur, and if you can't see it, shame on you. I decided to do the thing that best helped me hope. Drink. Red wine or beer or whiskey, I didn't care. I was still in Chicago. It had been 2 months. Now it was December. I was freelancing, writing for a science blog, and filing as many radio stories as I could. I did one about violence in crickets, one about violence in humans, one about violence in ticks. Heather and I filled the evenings by cooking, watching movies, sometimes going to talks. I'd make sure each activity came with an alcoholic beverage and another. And another. It felt great to feel warmth without warrant. I could rediscover my laughter, the springs that made my smile go. When I'd wake the next morning, the world would feel extra bleak, yes, my face extra puffy and unlovable, yes, but I'd just wait till evening when I could try to make it all go sparkly again. One night I met a friend, Stanzi, at a bar in Rogers Park. We ordered stouts and started talking about our work. She was working on a project to make poetry work on the radio. We started talking about the ideas-words divide, how it can be hard to watch your words fall flat, kersplat, before another person, how lonely it can feel inside a head with ideas you can't figure out how to spit out, and the dangerous power of the few who seem to understand you. I told her about my obsession with David Starr Jordan, the earthquake, the sewing needle. So it's sort of about why, I said, what drives a person to keep going? All she said was, huh, in the moment, and I felt a little deflated. But a longer reply came the next afternoon via email. And your story, the man who builds something so precious, so ornate, only to see it all crumble, where does he relocate his will to go on? Kafka calls it the indestructible, the thing at the bottom of each individual that keeps going whether they feel like going or not. The indestructible is a place that has nothing to do with optimism. Instead, it's something far deeper and far less self-conscious than optimism. The indestructible is the thing we mask with all sorts of other symbols, hopes, and ambitions that don't force you to acknowledge what is underneath. Well, if you do, or are forced to, remove all those excesses, you get the indestructible. And once you acknowledge it, Kafka goes deeper. He doesn't let you think the indestructible is optimistic or positive. Instead, it is the thing that could actually rip us apart and destroy us. And so it goes. I loved it. The indestructible. It was a glorious concept because it gave me permission not to have to answer the question of if I was mad to keep charging toward unrealistic goals. It promised simply that if I disobeyed it, it would tear me apart. But I didn't think it quite fit David Starr Jordan. The indestructible seemed like an affliction for fools, romantics, sad king-loving posers so fueled by an internal passion it could fog up their view of the world. But David Starr Jordan? No way. His entire life work was committed to wiping away the steam that such passion can leave upon the lenses of the eyes. But I wanted to make sure. So I went back to his memoir, armed with this new word, indestructible, supposedly animating ideas formerly inert to me. I searched for evidence of it, hiding in David's descriptions. I reread the sections about Rufus's death, Susan's death, Barbara's death, the lightning strike, the earthquake, and then I saw it. Buried in a lengthy excerpt in microscopic font, it was a quotation of his own work, a personal essay he had written just a few days after the earthquake while he was still raw, trying to process the extent of the damage to San Francisco. Never since man began to plan and to create has there been such a destruction of the results of human effort. Never has a great calamity been met with so little repining. Never before has the common man shown himself so hopeful, so courageous, so sure of himself and his future. For it is man, after all, that survives, and it is the will of man that shapes the fates. It is the lesson of earthquake and fire that man cannot be shaken and cannot be burned. The houses he builds are houses of cards, but he stands outside of them and can build again. It is a wonderful thing to build a great city. More wonderful still is it to be a city, for a city is composed of men, and forever man must rise above his own creations. That which is in man is greater than all that he can do. What a wonderful, rousing call to arms. What a glorious pat on the back and squeeze of the shoulders, with only one tiny problem. If you examine his words closely, you will see it. The tiny grain of sand that forms the pearl is a lie. It is the will of man that shapes the fates. It was the kind of lie he promised he would never tell himself. It was the kind of lie he had warned would lead to evil. It was the kind of lie he spent his career crusading against. Nature, no respecter of persons. The kind of lie he said was worth fighting to the death. Even he needed to believe it was true, so as not to be consumed by despair. Chapter 8, On Delusion. So there it was. As David swept up the glass in his lab, as he began to try to piece his life back together, the thing he was whispering to himself was a lie. It is the will of man that shapes the fates. It was shocking to see, a surprise based on everything he stood for. But considering the fact that David ultimately ended up being able to salvage so much of his collection, considering that thousands of specimens remain today over a century later, considering that by so many measures, David Starr Jordan's life turned out to be one of unusual success. The wives, the presidencies, the awards, the Garden of Eden complete with dog-riding monkeys and Latin-speaking parrots and taxonomy-loving children. I was beginning to wonder if self-delusion was such a bad thing. Maybe he and my father didn't need to be so moralistic about it, calling it a sin to avoid at all costs. I decided to put my morality on the shelf for a moment and see what the professionals had to say about the matter. Was self-delusion as dangerous as David and my father warned? For a long time, society's moral authorities would have said yes. The Bible, I've heard, looks down on self-delusion, calling hubris a cardinal sin and promising that if you forego it, you'll get the best goody of all. The meek shall inherit the earth. The ancient Greeks, too, were famously opposed to hubris, Icarus tumbling down from the sky, waxed and feathered by the sun. By the Enlightenment, Voltaire was decrying optimism as a most insidious evil for how it made you blind to suffering. By the 20th century, the medical experts concurred. Self-delusion was seen as a mental defect by influential psychologists like Freud, Maslow, and Erikson, a problem envisioned to be corrected with therapy. An accurate view, on the other hand, was seen as a, quote, hallmark of mental health. But as the 20th century roared on, clinical psychologists began noticing odd things. Their healthier patients, the ones leading easier lives, bouncing back more quickly after setbacks, getting jobs, friends, lovers, all the gold rings on the carousel of life, seemed to carry the rosy mark of self-delusion. So starting in the 1970s, a wave of researchers began running experiments to see if it was true. And time again, they found that, indeed, mentally healthy people rated themselves as more attractive than they were, more helpful, more intelligent, more in control of chance events like rolling dice or picking winning lottery numbers than they possibly could be. When they looked into their past, they remembered their successes with more ease than their failures. When they looked into their future, they voted themselves as more likely to succeed than their friends and classmates. Those people, on the other hand, with that oh-so-hailed virtue of accurate perception, ding, 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 you guessed it, clinically depressed. They struggled in their lives, found it harder to recoup after setbacks, often had more trouble in work and relationships. So, a few modifications were made in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. A few traits slid from the proverbial unhealthy column to the healthy one. The term delusions was neutered to positive illusions. And by the late 1980s, largely because of a seminal paper by psychologists Shelley Taylor and Jonathan Brown that reviewed over 200 studies that had shown a range of benefits of living with a positively warped worldview, it became widely accepted that a dash of self-deception was good for the bones. All this maybe you've heard. What you might not know is that this change in belief about how a healthy person should be oriented to reality changed what goes on in the therapist's office. Many therapists started practicing techniques like story editing or reframing to gently coax a patient into tinting her perception of herself into a more rosy one. The self-deception had to be moderate, that was key. Multiple studies found that extreme denial and delusion were maladaptive. But gentle lies, white lies, little rosy rosebuds of lies, those could be hugely beneficial. The idea was that if you could take a person who was struggling and help guide her story of herself into a slightly more positive one, one in which she was a bit stronger than she was, kinder than she was, where her breakup was not as much her fault as maybe it was, then you could see profound effects in her life. Tim Wilson, a psychologist at the University of Virginia, was so bowled over by how small adjustments in narrative could change a life that he wrote a whole book called Redirect, compiling some of the most dramatic effects. College students who received story editing interventions got better grades, dropped out of school less, even had better health years later. Workers who underwent story editing interventions started showing up to work more. Traumatized people, taught to tweak their story of what had happened, made their way more quickly to a sense of peace. "Does it matter if you're lying to yourself?" I asked Wilson. "What's the harm?" he replied. "If it conquers a fear and doesn't lead to maladaptive behaviors in the future, I see no problem with it. A little lie can go a long way." "Sure." As I read through this seemingly bottomless Mary Poppins bag of goodies that positive illusions could apparently bring, deeper sense of well-being, more success at work and in relationships, even better physical health, it dawned on me that perhaps my dad had steered me astray with his insistence on nose-to-the-ants humility. Perhaps the greatest gift ever bestowed on us by evolution is the ability to believe we are more powerful than we are. It's a hard lot being a human, these psychologists explain. You walk around with the knowledge that the world is fundamentally uncaring, that no matter how hard you work, there is no promise of success, that you are competing against billions, that you are vulnerable to the elements, and that everything you ever love will eventually be destroyed. A little lie can take the edge off, can help you keep charging forward into the gauntlet of life where you sometimes, accidentally, prevail. As the 1980s whirled on, snap bracelets, neon shirts, and parenting books containing tactics for inflating a child's self-esteem were pressed, printed, and purchased. What had formerly been viewed with suspicion was now being prescribed in psychologists' offices, scooped heartily into teaching manuals, and folded into elementary school curricula. The 1990s brought POGs, magic cards, and a statement in a National Institute of Mental Health report that, quote, considerable evidence suggests positive psychological benefits for people who believe their future will be rosier than they have any right to expect. Such optimism keeps people in a positive mood, motivates them to work toward future goals, fosters creative, productive work, and gives them a sense of being in control of their destiny. By the early 2000s, a high school math teacher named Angela Duckworth had decided to get her doctorate in psychology. For years, she had wondered why some of her students seemed to struggle more than others. She wanted to figure out what it was the achievers had. A few years later, she unearthed a trait she named grit that seemed to be the magic ingredient. Grit, a catchier word for persistence. Grit, the robotic plunging at, quote, extremely long-term objectives without positive feedback. Grit, the ability to bang one's head repeatedly against a wall. She'd seen it in West Point cadets and CEOs and people at the top of their game in every profession. Musicians, athletes, chefs. Forget talent, creativity, kindness, IQ. Pure grit seemed to be the thing that would get you ahead. And what cognitive glitch helps you achieve grit? Positive illusions. Other studies showed that if you had positive illusions, you were less likely to experience discouragement after setbacks. And while grit is a cocktail of many traits, one of its most important ones is just that. An ability to keep going after setbacks, to keep going in the face of no evidence that what you are striving for will ever work. Or, as Duckworth puts it, maintaining effort and interest over years despite failure, adversity, and plateaus in progress. Perhaps the best part of grit, its most hopeful attribute, the one that squared most nicely with the American dream, was that it did not appear to be biologically based. Grit, this magical quality that could turn dreams into reality, could be taught. Type grit into Amazon today and you will find a long list of how-to books. Grit, how to keep going when you want to give up. Grit, the new science of what it takes to persevere, flourish, succeed. Grit to great, how perseverance, passion, and pluck take you from ordinary to extraordinary. A little bottle pops up too. A little black pill bottle with neon green lettering that says, True Grit Test Booster. Inside are 120 tablets of, quote, science-based, research-backed, fully disclosed, and results-oriented supplements that will improve your physical performance from the gym to the streets. I thought of the very first photo I ever saw of David Starr Jordan, the one of him with his wild white hair and hardened gaze. I thought of that shield of optimism he was so proud to possess, of the colleague who said that no matter how bad the day, David could always be found humming a tune adown the arcade. In many ways, he is the poster child for grit. Nearly quoting Duckworth's definition of the trait, David described himself this way. I became accustomed to work persistently toward desired ends and then take the upshot calmly. Moreover, I never worry over a mischance once it's passed. Indeed, throughout his life, you can watch him fending off misfortune in real time. He's a sort of Rumpelstiltskin of the dis, able to take any rejection, insult, or failure and magically transform it into a compliment. At one point in his memoir, he effortlessly transmutes a string of failures into a bouquet of compliments. In college, he lost the botany prize because, as he explains, his thinking was too expansive for standardized tests. He lost the entomology prize because he was too generous. He stood back to let a poorer student win the money. And the French history prize he lost because he was too ethical, forfeiting his chance to try when he decided its rules were unfair. Historian Luther Speer, who wrote his dissertation on David Starr Jordan, noticed the same phenomenon, how he had a knack for slyly editing out or omitting information that would hurt his self-image. It's remarkable to watch how deftly David fends off potential character attacks. Breathtaking, almost. Like watching an acrobat soar through the air, pulling flips and turns that seem impossible. There he goes, encountering the ugly fact of his beloved Charlie's sexual indiscretions, Can he possibly do it? Stay airborne? Not let the information puncture his lofty view of himself and his associates? Out of nowhere, it seems he grabs a trapeze, a handhold, a way of keeping himself afloat. He will accuse the accuser of, quote, sexual perversity, and like that, poof, the accusation disappears. When Jane Stanford accuses him of nepotism, he admits to never opening that trunk full of applications for positions in the faculty, but he says he did so to help the university. Since his friends were the greatest scientists in all the land, what use would it be to consider strangers? Voila, the criticism becomes proof of his virtue. As you watch David go, you begin to wonder if he ever feels the stings of criticism, or has he become so adept at wielding his trusty shield that they never even touch his heart? Whatever the case, it works for him. He loses a wife and wins another quickly. He loses a fish collection and rebuilds a bigger one. He is promoted to higher and higher offices. The awards and medals start clattering in for teaching, for ichthyology, for contributions to higher ed. An odd alchemy of delusion right before your eyes. Little lies transmuting into bronze, silver, gold. Forget millennia of warnings to stay humble. Maybe this is just how it works in a godless system. Maybe David Starr Jordan is proof that a steady dose of hubris is the best way of overcoming doomed odds. Every age gets the lunatics it deserves, British historian Roy Porter once wrote. So what will become of us? This nation programming its kids to ignore reality when convenient, to whisper anything they need to keep themselves going. Is there any downside to living life behind rose-colored lenses? It turns out there is a small army of researchers scattered across the country investigating just that. Their methodologies are fun to imagine. They follow cocky people around their offices and schoolyards, clipboards in hand, tallying up their every social foible. And their results complicate the idea that positive illusions bring forth unmitigated good. Delroy Paulus found that while college students are initially drawn to those students with inflated self-esteem, over time the group grows weary of them, rating them more negatively. Tomas Chamorro Premusic found that overconfidence has serious costs in the workplace. One of the most widely cited studies claiming that positive illusions correlate with better physical health turned out to contain errors that rendered the results not significant. Michael Duffner, who did a meta-analysis of hundreds of studies on self-enhancement, found that over time, an overconfident person's boasting can end up alienating others. While the overconfident person might not ever realize it, they may be losing out on benefits that come from being well-regarded in a community. There may be fewer rakes lent, fewer invitations to potlucks, fewer positive recommendations for jobs. But it's not just the social toll. Inside the thick-walled bubble of self-delusion, the pain can slowly accumulate. Wilberta Donovan found that new mothers with a high illusion of control experienced more feelings of helplessness when their babies wouldn't stop crying than do their depressive counterparts. Richard Robbins and Jennifer Beer looked at college students over 4 years and found that while students with high positive illusions were happier in the short term, because they thought they did better on tasks than they actually did, over time their ratings of well-being took a nosedive. You're setting yourself up for disappointment was how Robbins and Beer explained it. Short-term benefits, but long-term costs. In other words, the lie catches up. The power of the rosy lens seems to have a limit. And when it runs out, the fact of your impotence will really sting. I think of these psychologists as the quiet, ragtag troop of cheerleaders for low self-worth. Their pom-poms are droopy. They whisper when they cheer, "Be humble, be blue. Who's the best? Not you." And their head cheerleader, with his head hung, is probably Roy Baumeister. He's a psychologist who found his way into this stuff when he began looking into the psychological causes of aggression. While the traditional wisdom had been, as Baumeister explains, that low self-esteem underlies aggression, he wanted to make sure. So he grabbed a bunch of college students with varying levels of self-esteem, insulted them, and waited to see who would lash out. Their violence, by the way, he measured by seeing how loudly they blasted an obnoxious sound at people. To noise blast or not to noise blast, tis the question. And he saw something shocking. Something that, because it came on the heels of such a widespread effort to inflate children's self-esteem, troubled him greatly. That it was people with a grandiose view of themselves who strike out. In other words, Baumeister and his colleague Brad J. Bushman discovered what depressed people had known all along. If you tell a person with low self-esteem you suck, they say, "You're right," and roll back under the covers. It's the esteem-bloated person who has enough belief in himself to classify such an insult as untrue who bothers striking back. Aggressors often think very highly of themselves, Baumeister and Bushman write, as evidenced by nationalistic imperialism, master race ideologies, aristocratic dueling, playground bullies, and street gang rhetoric. Odd, too, how many people who might score high on tests for positive illusions share a peculiar quirk with David Starr Jordan, a belief that they can control chaos with their very own hands. Fidel Castro once proposed building a shield around Cuba to protect it from hurricanes. Moscow Mayor Yuri Luzhkov wanted to stop snowfall by spraying a chemical mist of cement upon the clouds. And speaking of cement barriers, there was once a man of some power in this country who wanted to build a, quote, physically imposing wall made of concrete or steel to protect against a force as inevitable and enriching as wind. Baumeister and Bushman are quick to point out that not all high self-esteem is bad. They often find themselves needing to explain, palms in the air, that high self-esteem can be great. High self-esteem, they say, can make you freakishly peaceful, or exceptionally non-aggressive, as they put it, because you're so comfortable with yourself that criticism does not threaten your self-worth. They believe it's the very small subset of people with easily threatened high self-esteem that are the dangerous ones. In plainer terms, Baumeister and Bushman write, it is not so much the people who regard themselves as superior beings who are the most dangerous, but rather those who have a strong desire to regard themselves as superior beings. People who are preoccupied with validating a grandiose self-image apparently find criticism highly upsetting and lash out against the source of it. I thought back to the eerie fish I had seen at the National Collection, the one fish in the sea David Starr Jordan had named after himself, the spiny Möbius strip of a dragon, with two opposing sides curled seamlessly into one, Jordan of the no corners. Was there a message hidden in his choice? A nod to a dark side underlying his charm? One of Jordan's most double-edged talents, writes Luther Speer, was his ability to persuade himself that he was doing the right thing and then pursue his goal with seemingly boundless energy. He prided himself on his tolerance and liberality, but Jordan was not reluctant to use a cannon to swat a fly. Chapter 9. The Bitterest Thing in the World. Let's return to 1905, a year before the earthquake, when David's fish collection was still standing tall, but his presidency was looking like it could topple. Jane Stanford's spy had written up the damning report accusing David of whitewashing a sex scandal and running the university like a leader of a gang. The report had been circulated to the Board of Trustees, and rumors were flying that Jane was about to fire him. It was odd timing then that just a couple weeks into the year, Jane Stanford was poisoned. According to reports, on January 14, 1905, she was at home in her San Francisco townhouse, getting ready for bed when she took a big swig of water poured from her usual source, the tank of Poland Spring water in her kitchen. She tasted something so alarming and astringent that she immediately stuck her fingers down her throat to force vomiting. She summoned her assistants, Bertha and Elizabeth, to help. After calming her, they both tasted the water and, noting a queer and bitter taste, took the tank to a nearby chemist who analyzed it and found it contained lethal amounts of strychnine. Jane survived, but was understandably shaken. A detective turned up no leads. The investigation had focused solely on her household staff, the maid, the cook, the secretary, the ex-butler, and ended up clearing everybody. A novelist, paid to speculate on the intentions of the poisoner for the San Francisco Examiner, speculated it must have been done by a subordinate of Jane's who had been, quote, brooding over the intellectual and other defects of the employer for so long that the contempt galled by the chain of servitude had grown into the most murderous hatred of all. Knowing there was someone out there who wanted her dead, but not knowing who, Jane set sail for Hawaii, hoping that a few weeks in the tropics would calm her nerves. She brought her longtime secretary, Bertha, and a new maid, May, and they all settled into two rooms at the Moana Hotel, a lavish new resort with ionic columns, ornate balconies, and an electric-powered elevator right on the shores of Waikiki. According to weather data, the last day of Jane's life was a stunner. Sunny, highs in the 60s. Jane and her entourage, who had been on the island for about a week, decided to take a carriage up to the Pali Overlook for a scenic picnic. They brought with them a picnic basket prepared by the hotel's kitchen staff containing freshly baked gingerbread, hard-boiled eggs, meat and cheese sandwiches, chocolates, and coffee. For a few hours, they sat in the shade, enjoying the ocean view, picking at their snacks, and reading aloud to one another from a sci-fi novel. In the late afternoon, they returned to the hotel, rested for a bit, and had a light dinner of soup. Then, as Jane was readying herself for bed, she asked Bertha to leave out her medications, baking soda and herbal cascara capsules to help with digestion. Bertha left out a spoonful of baking soda and one cascara capsule, and around 9 p.m., she and May retired to their room across the hall. Frogs chirping, waves lapping, slumber. At approximately 11:15 p.m., Jane's assistants were awakened by cries coming from across the hall. "Bertha, May," Jane called. "I am so sick." They hurried to Jane's room, opened the door, and found Jane keeled over. She was having trouble opening her mouth, her jaw muscles beginning to clamp down against her will. Through widened eyes and barricaded teeth, Jane bleated, "I have no control of my body. I think I have been poisoned again." The baking soda spoon gleamed empty on her bedside table. By that point, the man staying next door, having heard the commotion, had rushed over to help. He ran for a doctor. A few minutes later, a sleepy, doe-eyed Dr. Francis Humphrey arrived, medicine bag in hand. He sat with Jane, gently palpating her jaw, trying to coax her muscles into relaxing, and finally yanking out her dentures so he could give her some mustard water to induce vomiting. But it was no use. Jane looked at Dr. Humphrey with eyes wide as her body began to contort in stranger and stranger ways. Her toes pigeoned inward, her fists clenched into rocks, and her legs splayed open into an unseemly spread eagle. Helpless, horrified, she stared at something somewhere just beyond or within her and pleaded through toothless gums, "Oh God, forgive me my sins." She was dead only 15 minutes after it had all begun, by 11:30. Two more doctors arrived just a few minutes later, one with a stomach pump dangling uselessly from his hand. All three doctors tasted the baking soda remaining in the bottle and noted a foreign, bitter taste. The sheriff arrived and wrapped the spoon and glass in paper and sent them to the toxicologist's office and sent Jane's body to the morgue. Seven physicians were called in to conduct the autopsy because of the high-profile nature of the case. They scanned Jane's skin, searching for evidence of cuts or abrasions, but finding none, they ruled out tetanus, which could have explained the convulsions and lockjaw. The chief pathologist on the case, Clifford Brown Wood, was so struck by the rigidity of Jane's fists that he just kept uncoiling her fingers and watching them recoil, uncoil, recoil, uncoil, recoil. The toxicologist got to work examining the contents of the bottle of baking soda and the contents of Jane's intestines. They found traces of strychnine in both. A jury of six citizens was convened, shown the body, and then made to sit through 3 days of testimony. They heard from the toxicologist, who had seen the bright red indicative of strychnine appear on the chemical test he performed on her organs. They heard from the chemist who had watched as hard white octahedral crystals of strychnine precipitated out of a solution made from her bottle of baking soda. From the seasoned physician who said the immediate rigidity of Jane's muscles was far more extreme than rigor mortis and, quote, a condition that I don't recall having seen before in 20 years of practicing medicine on any body. They heard from three eyewitnesses, Bertha, May, and Dr. Humphrey, who each said they watched Jane convulse to death in a matter of minutes. It took the jury 2 minutes to settle on a verdict. Jane Stanford, they decided, had died from, quote, strychnine having been introduced into a bottle of bicarbonate of soda with felonious intent by some person or persons to this jury unknown. The newspapers scooped the jury and printed the finding ahead of the verdict. Mrs. Stanford dies, poisoned, blared the front page of the San Francisco Evening Bulletin on March 1, 1905. David Starr Jordan, however, from over 1,000 miles away on California's coast, did not agree. Upon learning that the death would likely be ruled a poisoning, he set sail for Hawaii. He told the New York Times his visit had nothing whatever to do with the investigation which the police of San Francisco and Honolulu are conducting, that he was only there to escort Jane's body home. But records show he hired a doctor and paid him the hefty sum of $350, about $10,000 today, to re-examine the case. The man David selected had only been practicing medicine for a couple of years. His name was Ernest Waterhouse, and though he never examined the body or any of the evidence, after a skim of a book on poisoning, conversations with a couple of the witnesses, and a series of meetings with David, in his hands, the explanation of Jane's death took an acrobatic turn. In a typed memo to David, which David had instructed he prepared for him, Dr. Waterhouse declared that he was decidedly not convinced that Jane Stanford had been poisoned. What concerned him was the amount of strychnine found in her belly and bottle. He wasn't sure it was enough to have killed her. So how to explain the violent convulsions, the lockjaw, the whole rapid death thing? Pause. Gingerbread. After Jane's secretary, Bertha, was interviewed a second time, that picnic on the Polly transformed into a grotesque feast of rancid gingerbread. Now Bertha said that the gingerbread had not been freshly cooked, as she originally testified to the police and the hotel continued to claim, but undercooked. Jane had not stopped eating the bread upon discovering its supposedly wet center, but instead kept going, inhaling gob after gob of the sloppy, eggy dough. And apparently that still wasn't enough. According to this new interview with Bertha, Jane then sucked down 8 sandwiches filled with thick slabs of beef tongue and Swiss cheese, multiple cups of cold coffee, and over 12 French candies. How does a picnic turn into a feeding frenzy in just one interview? Is it coercion? Suggestion? Confession? I don't know. All I know is that after a couple of days on the island, David Starr Jordan had become, quote, morally certain that Jane Stanford had not been maliciously poisoned, but had instead died from overconsumption. He informed the New York Times that he was, quote, wholly convinced her death was due to heart failure triggered by a combination of overexertion from reclining on a picnic blanket and consuming a, quote, surfeit of unsuitable food. You could die from eating too much gingerbread, Seema Yasmin, a doctor and former disease detective for the CDC, told me when I called her to ask about the details of Jane's case. But 11 hours later? She was very stuck on the time delay. She said anything can become toxic at the right dose. I mean, you can die from drinking too much water. But she didn't think 2 or 3 servings of even raw gingerbread would do the trick. As for the combination of overeating and overexertion causing some sort of heart failure, again, she said it was possible, but it would have likely happened right there at the picnic. People have a heart attack when they are on the phone with the electricity company having a big fight, she said, and they're very stressed out and they have angina, and that emotional stress causes the heart vessels to spasm and then they have a heart attack. But 11 hours earlier, and then it happens? She paused. That doesn't sound so feasible. She asked if tetanus had been considered, and I told her they had ruled it out after finding no cuts on Jane's skin. When I finally told her that small amounts of strychnine had been found in Jane's intestines and medicine bottle, she said, oh. Then, wow, that seems a lot like a strychnine poisoning. She told me that strychnine is known as, quote, the poison of Hollywood films, because it's that poison that does what you see in the movies, where somebody's eyes are rolling back in their head and they can't control their body and they're having seizures. These, like, very dramatic contortions where their body's twisting this way and that. That's what this poison does. She told me that even minuscule amounts can kill within 5 minutes of exposure. Hmm, I said. I began running her through the physician's notes made about Jane's heart. There were terms I didn't understand, and I wanted to make sure I wasn't missing something that would point to heart failure. I told her about the presence of cyanic blood found in the chambers, the insignificant amount of athermanous plaques of the mitral and semilunar valves, but nothing jumped out at her. Look, she said once I reached the end of the list, you could argue that at the end of the day, we're all going to die of our hearts not beating anymore because that's how we define death, unless it's brain death. But no, it doesn't sound like angina or myocarditis or even a heart attack. I'm sure she had a heart attack, you know, during that whole process, her heart muscle would have been impacted too. But it's just the overall picture. It sounds a lot like a strychnine poisoning. David Starr Jordan, however, without access to CDC detectives from the future, much preferred the explanation that he had helped pay for: death by natural causes. 4 days after landing on the island, he told the New York Times that as a doctor of medicine, a degree he himself had once called scarcely earned, he was more sure than ever that she was not poisoned. Her death? Due to gingerbread. The presence of strychnine in her body and medicine bottle? He explained it away as medicinal. There was just one more detail left, then, to explain away. Perhaps the most damning piece of evidence of all. An eyewitness account reported from inside the very body beginning to malfunction. As the electricity of Jane's body began to betray her, commanding her legs spread open, her jaw slammed shut, she managed to grab control of her tongue to steer out a crucial message. I think I have been poisoned again. To that, David and Dr. Waterhouse came up with a most logical explanation. Hysteria. Of course, Jane was faking being poisoned, faking the convulsions, faking the death. How marvelous it is to watch the acrobat as he flips through the air, pulling turns and accomplishing the seemingly impossible, to gaslight even someone's experience of death. On his final morning on the island, David awoke in his hotel room, pulled out a stack of hotel stationery, and began composing a public statement that he hoped would permanently debunk the theory of murder. He scribbled down a few words, then crossed a bunch of them out. He decided to remove any mention of the previous poisoning attempt, better if that wasn't on people's minds. He declared his medical certainty that Jane had died of natural causes, a combination of gluttony and overexertion. He concluded by laying thick praise on the Hawaii doctors whose medical opinions he was calling into question, thanking them for being, quote, generous-hearted, helpful, and sympathetic. He then signed the statement, sealed it, and gave it to a lawyer friend, instructing him to wait until after he set sail for home so he wouldn't risk any awkward confrontations with the doctors. After that, David had just one thing left to do. He threw on a nice suit, washed his hands of ink, strolled over to the Central Union Church in Honolulu, and slipped his freshly scrubbed palm around the cold handle of Jane Stanford's coffin. He took a deep breath and braced his quads for the honor of serving as one of her pallbearers. When David's statement hit the newspapers, the Hawaii doctors were horrified. They banded together and immediately released a counterstatement which read, "She did not die of angina pectoris because neither the symptoms of the attack nor the condition of the heart confirms that diagnosis. It is imbecile to think that a woman of Mrs. Stanford's age and known mental characteristics might have died of a hysterical seizure in half an hour. No board of health in existence could allow a certificate based on such a cause of death to go unchallenged." Imbecile? David immediately struck back, calling the key medical witness, Dr. Humphrey, a man without professional or personal standing. When the Hawaii doctors rushed to Humphrey's defense, David accused them all of colluding in a conspiracy, fabricating the diagnosis of murder as a way of getting money to perform the autopsy and coroner's inquest. A ludicrous accusation if you think about the number of people who would have had to have been in on it, not just the various doctors, but the random hotel guest who rushed to Jane's room, Jane's secretary, her maid, the sheriff, the undertaker, the coroner. No matter. Because of David's prestige, his power, a nation's disregard for its islands, something. The Hawaii doctor's account of what happened never really took hold on the mainland. You won't find much about the possibility of murder if you look on Stanford University's webpage. Jane Stanford's death is listed as never conclusively determined. And way down in a long profile of David Starr Jordan called Meet President Jordan, you'll find one sentence about his potential involvement in Jane Stanford's death. When she died under mysterious circumstances in February 1905, Jordan rushed to Hawaii to claim the body and, some believe, to quash reports that she had been poisoned. Although even these allusions are recent additions. For nearly a century, it was widely accepted that Jane had died of natural causes. Any rumors of more nefarious explanations had been so effectively discounted, they had pretty much disappeared. I learned about it all from a slim, gray, meticulously researched book called The Mysterious Death of Jane Stanford, published in 2003 by Robert W.P. Cutler, M.D. Toward the end of his life, Robert Cutler, a Stanford neurologist, had stumbled across an old newspaper article about an investigation into the poisoning of Jane Stanford while researching another project. Robert was shocked. He was a history buff and a proud Stanford man. Why had he never heard that the founding mother had potentially been poisoned? So he began digging. He could see from online databases that there were autopsy reports, court transcripts, eyewitness testimonies just sitting out there in Hawaii ready to be examined. However, by that point in his life, Robert could not safely leave his mountaintop home in Livermore, California. He had advanced emphysema and had to stay indoors, away from dust, tethered to an oxygen tank. So, with the help of his wife, Maggie, and a flock of archivists from Honolulu to San Francisco to Washington, D.C., he had documents scanned and mailed or, when it was Maggie, hand-delivered to the safety of his home office, where he set to the work of reading through them and writing up his findings. There's not a spare word in the book he put together. No dramatic speculation on people's motives or emotional states, just the evidence laid out as clearly as possible, with long quotations from the primary sources themselves. You feel that you are hearing the voices of the past speaking directly to you. The coroner's report, the eyewitness testimonies, the court transcripts, you hear them all. The book's slimness is his gift to the future, his attempt to sift truth from bullshit. He was able to get everything off to the presses and see the first edition come out into the world. And then he died. In his book, Robert Cutler, a medical doctor for more than three decades, is clear. Given Jane's symptoms and the discovery of strychnine in both her belly and medicine bottle, he believes she was poisoned. And after tracing David Starr Jordan's actions in the wake of her death, he believes it's hard not to conclude that David was trying to cover up the poisoning. Why? Perhaps to protect the university from scandal, perhaps for other reasons. Robert Cutler doesn't wager a guess. Other scholars go further. Bliss Carnachan, a Stanford English professor who studied the letters between Jane and her spy, thought the timing of the murder was fishy. He wrote that David, as a means of protecting his presidency, quote, had the motive. Richard White, a Stanford historian, began teaching a class called Who Killed Jane Stanford to try to uncover more clues. Each semester, he unleashes a dozen students or so on the archives to find new information. White's current guess is that Bertha did it, for the will money, but he remarks that the timing of Jane's death was remarkably lucky for David. He feels increasingly confident that no matter who did it, David covered up the poisoning. His students keep uncovering more of David's shady behavior in the wake of Jane's death. The letter from David's acquaintance assuring him that it is possible to die from eating too much food. The letter from an unknown person telling David he will be, quote, judged in the afterlife for covering up a crime. The letter from Jane's spy telling David his, quote, silence can't be bought. There's also the oddness of David's continuing to insist that Jane had died of natural causes, decades after anybody was suggesting otherwise. It crops up in weird places, speeches, newspaper articles, letters as David ages. White wonders why David would go to such lengths to keep asserting this version of events. It seems to White that something about Jane's death was still preying on David all the way to the end. It was a long drive up to Robert Cutler's mountaintop home. Endless switchbacks up a one-lane road through yellowing grass, dry earth. When I finally made it to the top, Maggie greeted me on the deck her husband hadn't been able to enjoy, pollen and dust too dangerous for his sensitive lungs. She led me to the kitchen. After pouring us each a cup of coffee, she told me that it had been hard to watch her husband fall into his researching obsession as he neared the end of his life. Spending his time buried in books instead of with her. But she said she thinks he felt a duty to make sure Jane's voice was heard, a duty to unearth a truth that had stayed buried for so long. I asked her if, even though her husband took such pains not to accuse David Starr Jordan of murder in the book, he might have privately wondered if David Starr Jordan had been involved. He absolutely believed that Jordan did it, she told me without needing time to think. Really? Oh yeah, he thought Jordan was rotten to the core. The drive back down felt shorter somehow. I was lost in my thoughts, thinking about my weird attachment to David Starr Jordan, my hope that he was the person who could lead me out of the mess I had made of my life. There was so much I admired about him, his sarcasm, his devotion to the quote hidden and insignificant flowers, his absurd walrus mustache, which reminded me of my dad's clownish push broom, his steel backbone, that gritty resolve that made him refuse to crumple in the face of whatever misfortune came his way. Is this what happens if you employ his sunny disposition? You become so callous, so impervious to obstacles that you can stomp out a woman's life, or at the very least be willing to cover up the truth of her death? A retired Stanford archivist whom I called after first hearing about Robert Cutler's book warned me not to be entranced by its theories. She called it truly not worth talking about, a work of speculation. The doctor needed a villain, she said, and urged I pay the book no mind, warning me not to fall prey to a juicy narrative. Historian Luther Speer said that Cutler's book convinced him that Jane Stanford had been poisoned, but to suggest David had ordered it was to cross from speculation to, quote, fantasy. I finally got myself out to Stanford University's archives, where dozens of David Starr Jordan's boxes of journals, letters, unpublished essays, and drawings lay in wait. I requested the maximum amount of material allowed per day. Morning after morning, I resisted the sunshine beckoning outside the windows, the scent of eucalyptus whispering, "Come hither." I was searching for some clear admission of guilt in those yellowing pages. On my fifth day, I came across a folder full of drawings. It was dated just a few years after Jane's death. This time, instead of flowers, it was monsters that David drew. Endless monsters, rendered in that same labored hand. They are wild with color. A lobster with a goat head. A porcupine with rainbow quills. A carnivorous kangaroo dripping magenta blood from her fangs, with a carnivorous baby in her pouch. Dragon after dragon, demon after demon, goat horns galore. They breathe fire, they drip blood, human limbs protrude from their jaws. In one, three squids are choking on their tails. In another, the night sky hemorrhages sharks and wolves and snakes. In another, there is a man with a walrus mustache. He is standing at the back of a crowd, looking off to his side at a woman wearing a floral hat. This man, this one man in a crowd of many, is the sole figure who sports a pair of devil's horns. They are sketched faintly above his head, as though they have just filled in. Deep at the bottom of a box, jangling with odds and ends, I found a small rectangular note card. It was from Jane Stanford's brother, Charles, thanking David for the condolence flowers he sent after Jane's death. I pictured David reading the card, his thumb pressing into the very same cardstock, and I felt a little shock of disgust. I came across a carefully cut out newspaper article, folded in half so its contents were hidden from view, titled, "Dr. Jordan's Statement is Riddled by the Experts." In it, the reporter refutes David's explanation of death by natural causes, showing item by item how the evidence points to a poisoning. The article concludes by suggesting that David Starr Jordan must be, quote, covering up a crime, and warns that the killer is still on the loose. Was the archivist right? I wondered as I flipped through thousands of pages, remnants of David's skin entering my nostrils. Was I doing exactly what I was beginning to suspect David of? Twisting the facts to keep my worldview intact? To confirm my daddy's belief that confidence corrupts? Despite my mounting suspicion of David, I forced myself to encounter his good side, to breathe it in. I carefully read the handwritten remembrance by Jessie, calling David the miracle of her life. His many poems, odes to the hidden and insignificant of this world, sea sponges and sea stars and even grass itself. I read about his tireless work protecting the fur seal from overhunting.